Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Colonel Wilkerson.
Back from
Without
the
further Sir, welcome back.
Good to be back amongst the living.
Amongst the living. Well, we know one person who's not amongst the living.
Lindsey Graham, the
Yep.
beast.
Now the question, there's a lot of questions coming up on where he died.
You know, guys, we talk on the show a lot about wars, power politics, particularly wars of attrition. And as I've said many times, as much more brilliant minds than myself have said over the years, armies travel on their stomachs. But in this case, it's a lot more than food. You have to arm with modern weapon systems your soldiers. So armies travel not only on their stomachs, but also on logistics, supply chains, and even resources, the resources that are in the ground. Now, everybody talks about purified, processed, rare earth minerals that mostly come the magnets that come out of China. But there's other minerals that are mundane. Minerals such as tungsten. Tungsten that is critical for everything. Almost every weapon system that Washington is producing right now, every jet, every tank, every ship, a lot of the submunitions and the main gun rounds, missiles, in some way, all of them contain tungsten. The U.S. hasn't mined tungsten since 2015, 10 years, preferring to buy from abroad. But something that these last conflicts and the Gulf War, what they've shown is that the American supply chain is actually very, very brittle. Washington's understanding this, and they're moving as fast as they can to solve this gaping hole. This is an issue that they're planning on closing.
So America needs its own tungsten mine. I mean, 2015 is the last time they mined it. And tungsten has shown itself, especially in these last conflicts that Washington has gotten itself into, it's shown that it plays an oversized role, more critical than most elements, much larger role than most people understand. It's not just a metal, it's national resilience and survival.
The U.S. government is putting billions of dollars on the line. So the question is, can Volt Strategic Mining get the job done? Volt's operating model is straightforward. Acquire historic mines, use modern exploitation tech to maximize value. The first rule of business, as they say, is location, location, location. So tungsten, which is priced near record highs, and Volt is right there in the place that it needs to be. They're not looking for new plays. They're not out exploring new areas that are high risk because maybe there is something there, maybe there isn't something there. They're located in mining-friendly states, such as Nevada, where is their flagship operation, and they're bringing back, revitalizing tungsten mines that were first put online back in World War II under the Defense Minerals Exploration Act. These are the mines that helped bring the minerals that defended the free world and beyond World War II. These are proven deposits, and they're going to be filling the needs of the U.S. government that are now in existence.
So Interstage Right, Volt Strategic Mining. It's trading under KNOX in Canada. That's KNOX. That's a sign in Canada, and KNXFF. That's a sign in the U.S. They're in the midst of setting up the biggest tungsten strategic project, not just in the U.S., but possibly in all of North America. So what I'm saying here is that this is a de-risked opportunity. They're not looking for new plays. This is a proven area. And tungsten is key, and globally, its prices are skyrocketing. Governments, corporations, they've all realized how much they need it. Not just for military, but also for civilian uses. And they're all scrambling right now to get their hands and lock in reliable sources. So areas like the Great Basin. So this is an area in Nevada. And it's getting some serious attention. This is, by the way, where the flagship operation project of Volt is located, in Nevada. This is North America's historic tungsten belt. The USGS estimated 168,000 tons of tungsten oxide could be located in this area. I mean, and then again, and this is a proven reserve. These are proven reserves that were exploited for quite a long time before one reason or another they were put down, and people started importing. And consider today's high prices. That could be an equivalent at 168 tons. It could be equivalent to $30 to $50 billion in the ground, and probably higher because prices are going to continue rising. Demand is skyrocketing, and markets are catching on to all of these shortages. Don't get me wrong. There's smart people working there. They're figuring this out that, oh my God, we need to lock in these sources. The position could appreciate a lot more than it is right now. And a lot of value, and Volt sitting right in the middle of that value.
Now, this is where it all gets real interesting. In under 12 months, so less than a year, the U.S. government has taken five major steps to rebuild its mineral supply chains, which are in a horrible condition. This includes the Executive Order 14231 for 14231, Project Volt. There are 55 foreign ministries focused directly on these critical minerals. All this is driven by the fact that the U.S. no longer mines tungstenes commercially since 2015. This is why Washington has committed $12 billion for Project Volt and additional federal support, all to establish and secure domestic supply. Washington is in overdrive. Let's not kid ourselves, as they tend to be at when they realize how bad off they are. This has become a national priority. The Pentagon is now actively funding and developing domestic supply chains for the very tungsten that is in the ground at the Volt project. This is an active White House directive. Volt is working hard, systematically assembling what will shape up to be probably the biggest massive U.S. tungsten, and not just U.S., probably North American tungsten profile. Portfolio. If you want to learn more about this, check out my description. There's a link in the description that'll take you to Volt's page where you can learn more about the opportunities that Volt has. And again, a special thanks to Volt Strategic Mining for making today's video possible. And now back to the video.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video, or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet, send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Because the time frames don't seem to add up as far as how long it takes to get back and when the emergency started. Friend Larry Johnson, he was the first one to start calculating the time frames. It came out, well, wait a minute, there's about 3 hour issue here, you know. So
you think they stuck him in Ukraine?
Maybe, or maybe just a, you know, heart attack in Ukraine, who knows. Maybe he was partying
no
a little
man.
Too hard with Zelensky.
He's a fellow South Carolinian, and I have known him indirectly, somewhat directly, but indirectly for a long time because my father was a big supporter of him when he first ran for the House of Representatives. My father quit being a supporter of him when he decided, after promising in his first campaign that he would be term limited, that he would not linger in Washington, as it were. And my father went to he actually had a home very close to where my father's home was, in Cross Creek Plantation near Seneca, South Carolina. And so my father went over and said, essentially, you know, I've been giving you a lot of money, and I don't think I'm going to give you any more money because you've broken your promise. And he said, well, I'm running for the Senate, so I'm not really breaking my promise. My father said, no, no, no. You said you'd be term limited, period. It doesn't mean that you can change houses and not be term limited. And so my father quit funding him. And after that, it was around the table when I would visit South Carolina talking to my dad. And he got more and more really down on Jim DeMint, who was another Cretan from South Carolina, and Lindsey Graham. And by the time we got to the end, my father was. I wouldn't vote for Lindsey Graham if he was the last American left alive.
Was he an American?
Good
I mean, I know what
question.
his passport said,
Well,
but
almost anyone, including the British consul in Charleston during the seminal years of our Civil War, almost anyone would question whether any South Carolinian were an American.
No, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. From North Carolina, I remember that it was the Yankees that invaded the real America. The war of Yankee aggression.
If you read this consul's dispatches back to first the foreign minister in Britain and then to the actual prime minister, because the prime minister got very interested in it, because they were trying to make up their mind, as you probably know, as to whether or not they were going to support the Confederacy. And the weight was going towards support. Antietam did a little bit to attenuate that, but the price of cotton and so forth, and Egyptian cotton versus South Carolinian cotton and so on, was weighing heavily. And this consul probably stopped the British government from ultimately supporting the South because of his dispatches back on what these people really were like. And it's an incredible book. Our Man
Well,
in Charleston is the name of the book. An incredible book.
the Russian government did a lot to dissuade him too, because in 63 the Russian fleets arrived in New York and San Francisco to tell the British and the French not to intervene. Of course, I don't know how much it was the smartest move in the long run or not, but it
Well,
was
I thought about that too with regard to England. They were very much opposed to the slave trade by that time, and that's what their navy was doing on the high seas mostly, was trying to disrupt the slave trade. That was a complete loss, of course, but it was a change. And they could have, shall we say, somewhat adumbrated, if not stalled entirely, the rise of America if they had created two states that would have been constantly at each other's throats.
Well, I mean, slavery in the South would have gone away anyways, because it was just economically unfeasible in the long run, especially with automation. But yeah, they could have. And Alexander II, I think he chose his sides because of the Crimean War 10 years earlier. Like, which one's the British and the French on? We'll be on the other side. No, just out
That's
of
all,
emotional.
that's what created the Russophobia. Those bastards are always against us.
Well, I think the fact that Catherine the Great formed the League of Armed Neutrality to stop the British from trying to embargo, not embargo, blockade trade to the colonies, that kind of pissed them off a lot too.
They did come back though. They came back right after the 10 days that shook the world and tried to unshake the world.
So yeah, that was I think
Perfidious Albion. That's what they should be called, Perfidious Albion. I think the French coined that phrase, but with great reason, but
Well, what we've heard from Zelensky, who said that I'm gonna miss my talks with
Lindsay,
Graham. Oh,
I
I don't
bet,
know what
I
deep
bet.
talks they had, but
Probably about the Epstein files.
And then Netanyahu said he was the best friend Israel ever had, which I probably is. That's actually probably the truth.
And that is condemnation of him alone. All by itself, that remark is condemnation of Lindsey Graham.
I mean, was there a war that the man didn't like? Was there
I'm
ever
not
a
aware of
conflict
it.
he wasn't he
I'm
wasn't all
not aware of
gung-ho?
it. I think there was a remarkable affinity toward the end between Trump and Graham. And I think that affinity was forged. This is just a guess, but I know something about Lindsay's sexual escapades. And I think that truce between Trump and Graham was forged initially out of the Epstein files and both men's involvement deeply in those files.
Oh. So Graham is in the Epstein files.
Oh, I think he's there writ large, and he's there in a much more heinous way than Donald Trump.
Yeah, because his name, that's something that everybody was mentioning, because his name never showed up. I guess the Israelis didn't want to give it out.
No. His sexual peccadilloes were well known in South Carolina, and they involved little boys and.
Well, anything involving in children in general, unacceptable in any manner or form.
Except, you know, the Theban warriors used to be made to stand with their lover, who was 12 or 13 years old, staked beside them so that they wouldn't retreat. Demosthenes talks about that.
Yeah.
That's how they kept the Theban warriors true warriors. They had to defend that young lover in order to remain where they were. So
what's interesting is the way societies go, you know, when the Romans conquered Greece. So Greece was all into the every perversion, hedonism, everything else. And nobody wanted to fight, by the way. Nobody was having kids, too. Rome was all about strict, you know, state family, God state family. That was it. You know, your pantheon, to Rome and your family. Very strict, very disciplined. And they conquered him. And then flip, you know, look, 500, 600 years later, and Rome is, you know, hedonistic as hell. Nobody wants to have kids. Nobody, it's anything goes. And Greece
Mary Beard's new book. In my mind, one of the eminent classicists in the world, it's called The 12 Caesars. She takes the end of the Republic with Julius's assassination, and she goes through Domitian and Suetonius's 12 Caesars. Mm-hmm. And if you read that book, and I'm sure Mary, tongue-in-cheek and sometimes not tongue-in-cheek, means this in her book, you are reading about the American Empire today.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Epstein case, all those things, they're there vividly displayed with this succession of emperors. And it includes emperors that we have come to, in some ways, admire, and those we haven't come to admire, like Nero. But it includes others that, like Marcus Aurelius, who we've come to sort of elevate to a position of. And yet she shows you how the court in particular demonstrates everything that Donald Trump's court demonstrates today in spades.
Has Trump named a horse senator yet?
Probably.
I think that's going to be a pretty good sign right there.
Lindsay's sister's going to be, what's his name, McMaster, the governor of South Carolina, just appointed Lindsay's sister to fill his role.
I heard that. I wasn't sure whether it was real or not. Ah, geez.
I think it is, yeah.
We didn't have the apple falling from the tree. It's still stuck to that tree.
I don't know his sister from Adam, but as my sister said one time, like you just intimated, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree.
Jeez. Yeah, that's, jeez. South Carolina just doesn't get a break. They can't get a decent person up there.
We always said in South Carolina that North Carolina was better.
The problem with North Carolina, I mean, I haven't lived in North Carolina, obviously, in 20 years, but I lived a very large chunk of my life in North Carolina. And the problem with North Carolina, I think the same problem that Texas is having right now with Californians, is all the New Yorkers moved down, so they ruined their own state. They moved down to North Carolina, and they haven't bought a clue. They have no idea why their state failed. So they start voting for the exact same crap that they pushed through in their states, and they start ruining the North Carolina. I call them economic locusts.
Yeah.
And Californians are doing the same thing in Texas.
And the research triangle that I watched grow up was a large attractor for that.
Oh, yeah.
Brought a lot of people in.
Well, we had Cary next door to Raleigh. Cary was a containment area for relocated Yankees. And you know, I was an assistant manager in the video store, which was a video store that was main competitor to Blockbuster at that time. And I knew that the Yankees started, the New Yorkers started moving to North to Charlotte, because they all started running in getting memberships, and they all had New York license, New York driver's licenses or IDs. And they all, most of them had never, it was Royal Insurance. It was one of the first companies to move down. And none of them had ever driven before. So they all run out and get driver's licenses. And it's just wrecks all over the city for like the next year while they're learning how to drive. So yeah, like, yep, that was the first wave that started coming. Hasn't stopped since.
North Carolina right now, as I read it politically, has, and I have a lot of friends in North Carolina, all the way from Asheville to Winston-Salem to Raleigh. It's almost evenly divided,
Yep.
50-50. And that's an impossible democratic situation
Oh,
when
yeah.
you're that way. You can't decide anything. You can't do anything. And when you do something, it's tyranny. They actually had a college campus. I forget which one it was. It was a small school. I should remember the name, but the district, the voting district, county something line ran right through the campus. And so you had Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other side trying to get absentee ballots for these students based on where they live. And then a sort of a civil war broke out on the campus. And the students finally said, "The hell with all of you, a pox on all your houses. We're not going to vote," because it was such a damn mess. With the proximity was the real problem, but it was exemplifying the problem in North Carolina. 50-50. People out trying to get students from California who are there and can vote absentee in North Carolina if they want to vote. How idiotic is that? And yet they're doing it and spending money on doing it.
Oh, you got Duke University over in Durham. I don't know how Durham is right now, but Durham used to be part of my French a shithole. It had nice areas, but most of it was a gangster run. And you had one of the most expensive universities in America, and then one side of it backed up right into a ghetto, basically. It's this rundown, drug-infested region. It's like, oh, geez, you think you're sending your kids to an Ivy League university, and you got drug dealers right across the street from it.
You should see
Durham.
University of Pennsylvania or Drexel in the neighborhood they're in Philadelphia. Ooh, went up there to play daughter, my granddaughter to play. I think they were playing Drexel, and in soccer, and driving to the soccer field was like, okay, are we going to be killed en route? You wonder sometimes how these universities survive in the environment that they're in. And then you also wonder about the people wandering around the streets and the people inside the enclave. That's a demonstration of abject poverty and abject wealth.
Especially with Duke. My God, it's and Duke is one of the, it's got great architecture at the
You'll
university.
appreciate this story. The head of my student veterans at William & Mary got accepted at Duke Medical School, went to the medical school, graduated recently, and I just had lunch with him about a month and a half ago. And he told me the most amazing story. He graduated and did his residency, did all the things he had to do, and then he moved to this little town in North Carolina. And he hung his shingle on his front porch, and he wanted to be a country doctor. Well, the first thing that happened was the local medical association approached him and told him he couldn't do that.
Really?
The local hospital then approached him and told him he couldn't do that. So he went and consulted with another older guy, very old guy, who was still doing practice out of his home. And the guy kind of laughed and said, "Son, let me tell you what you're up against. And so, long story short, Tim said he finally got it established. He was being paid in eggs, he was being paid in slabs of bacon and things like that, but he was doing what he wanted to do. He was practicing general medicine out of his home. And he was rapidly building up a pretty good clientele. And they're still fighting him. They're still fighting him, trying to get him to join the hospital association, the League of Health, all these other crappy things. And he said, "No, I'm not doing that. I'm going to be a freaking country doctor." And he's up against the whole freaking state.
He's, yeah, I've got a friend of mine. He's a he's a, well, he's a self-made millionaire in the mining industry because he was able to organize different services in Australia. And he was also a city councilman. But he started off as a dirt poor farmer's son in sheep farming until they had to shoot their flocks because Australia took the floor out from the price of wool. And then when the market collapsed, they told the farmers, we'll pay you, but you got to shoot the sheep per shot sheep. You can't even sell the meat; it has to be burnt. Well, after that, he goes to the U.S. and gets a degree as a horse dentist.
A horse dentist?
Yes, apparently there are separate profession called a
I'm
horse
an
dentist.
orthodontist for caballos.
Yes. So he comes back to Australia, and he said, he had to pay off his American school debt, and he comes back to Australia. He gets a practice going, everything's going great, and then the Veterinarian Association of Australia bans horse dentistry because they're not veterinarians. So only veterinarians are allowed to work on horse teeth. So that's why he went into mining, because he had to pay off a debt and he could no longer practice. They made him illegal because he wasn't a veterinarian. He didn't have a veterinarian degree.
That matches Tim's story. By the way,
So.
Tim's first patient was a guy who came up to him and knocked on his door and showed him his arm that his 2-ton truck had just fallen on. He was trying to adjust the leverage he had on jacking the truck up, and the truck collapsed on his arm. And Tim said, "You better come inside."
Holy crap.
And Tim took him into his kitchen and cleaned him up and everything. Long story short, he saved his hand and his forearm. And the guy came, abjectly, "What can I do for you? What can I give you?" So he's paying him in eggs and in layers, chickens. But this guy's eternally grateful to Tim, and he was his first patient.
Man, that's great. That's a wonderful story, saving the guy's arm. My God, he had a 2-ton. I'm surprised he had an arm left. It
Yeah,
wasn't pancaked or cut
Tim said
off.
he was lucky that he
My
had
God.
enough left to save.
Was he in shock when he arrived, or what?
Tim said he had to do a number of things to calm him down and clean the wound and do what he did.
Jeez.
But the
Yeah, I
guy,
mean.
he said, "This is what I wanted to do. These are the things, these are the kinds of things I want to do. I want to help people. And I want to
That's
do it
great.
at a minimum cost to them. And if they want to pay me in eggs or layers, chicken layers, I think they were Rhode Island Reds. If they want to pay me in corn, whatever, that's fine with me. We'll do a little calculation."
That's
These are rare people. This guy was a
yeah.
medic for the Rangers in
Oh.
Afghanistan for over 2 years. So when he went to Duke Medical, he was already probably the equivalent of a physician's assistant. You know how the military does
Oh,
things. He was
yeah.
a very proficient medic. So when he got to Duke, he was sort of in his second year, he was sort of teaching the doctors who were trying to teach him practical medicine.
Well, I mean, they I don't know if they, I think the Rangers do it too. I know the SF guys, because I knew an SF medic. They send them into ER rooms
Yeah.
to prepare to just, because when you're in a field, you got to operate. Yeah. What do you
Yeah.
got? Two twigs and a needle. Okay. That's it, and there you go.
Reminds me of my personal physician for a while, Nomi Shin. She's in Israel now. I don't know if she's still alive. She went to volunteer for the IDF, but she was a doctor on a carrier, and she was not qualified for surgery, and a guy had an appendectomy, necessity for an appendectomy. So the skipper of the carrier plus the flag embarked essentially said, I'm sorry, he's going to die if you don't do something. So she did the surgery. She did it splendidly and using textbooks, and she did it well. The guy survived, and so the Navy said to her, we're sending you to surgery school. So they sent her for 14 months to surgical school, and she became an official Navy surgeon. And then she served out their time. I think she had 3 years on that obligation, and she became a doctor here in Falls Church, Virginia. And she was treating my wife and me. In fact, she's the one that warned me about my wife having pancreatic cancer and was very good in the process of telling me she was going to die and telling her. And then she disappeared to go work for the IDF when Gaza broke out. And I haven't heard from her since. And she doesn't answer her cell phone or anything else. So I don't even know if she's still alive.
Yeah, that's got to be hard. I had an uncle who was 84 years old, got COVID. 2 days later, he's healthy. It's passed. And doctor's like, yeah, that's great. By the way, you got stage four intestinal cancer. Like, yeah, you never know.
My fishing buddy out in Idaho, I just came back a week or two ago from a ceremony we conducted up in the Bitterroot Mountains for him, commemorating him, put his ashes in his favorite river and that sort of thing. He was out chopping wood. We had just finished last year's fishing trip. He was out fishing, out chopping wood, and he just collapsed in the driveway. About 6 months later, after all kinds of pontificating among Spokane and Coeur d'Alene and other, oncologists, he was dead. Cancer just consumed his lower body. He had it in his spine originally. And then I knew something was wrong the last time we were fishing. He collapsed in the river and his rod started downstream towards me. And I had to reach out and get it. And I started towards him. I said, Lamar, what's the problem? He said, well, I just slipped. I should have known it was more than that.
Yeah.
He was the kind of guy I wouldn't talk about.
Yep. Well, do you think Graham's sister is going to take over for him, or think it's going to be another election?
In South Carolina, the governor will appoint her to fulfill his term, which was ending this time, I think. Because I'm giving money to the opponent. I think she's a physician, and she's very, very capable woman from everything I've seen. I don't think she has a chance in hell beating Lindsey Graham, or now beating his sister, probably, because his sister will probably throw herself into the race.
Yeah.
But I hope we can do something. You know, South Carolina has a bad habit of sending people forever. Strom Thurmond.
But Strom Thurmond at least was, at least as far as I knew from Strom Thurmond, Senator
Rich
Noah. Well, Strom Thurmond at least was against all the extra insane spending, things like that. So they had at least something.
I took my Marine Corps seminar to visit the Congress every year as part of our curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
1 year, we're visiting Strom. This is no joke. We're in his office in the Senate, and I line up my Marines and my two Air Force and my two Navy and my one CIA and what else did I have that year? I guess that was about it. Six Marines and the rest in the War College in my seminar. I line them all up, and Strom's going down the line being supported on his elbows by staff. They have to pick him up and move him down the line. He's, 98 at that time or something like that?
Was he still in 98?
He gets to me. He gets to me and he says, well, you're the teacher, huh? I said, yes, Senator, I'm the teacher. Where are you from, boy? I said, South Carolina. His eyes lit up. He removed his hand. He pumped my hand. He saw another vote. Then they drug him away. And we always had a little on-site seminar after our visits. And in that on-site seminar, one of the Marines asked me, he said, how old is that dude? Is he coherent? I said he's coherent enough for the people to tell him how to vote, and he votes.
Yep.
And
Well,
that's what it
I
was all about.
remember seeing a photograph when Strom Thurmond was 20-something, and he was a aide to the governor of South Carolina.
Yeah.
And the governor was having one of the last reunions for the veterans of the American Civil War. Yeah, this is, I guess, it was about 1920s, somewhere around
yeah.
there. Yeah, that was, when you start to figure out how old this guy really is at this point.
Out of World War II, my father elected to stay in the Army. He was a B-17 guy in World War II, but he elected when the Air Force was created and stood up to go into the Army and then to sort of partially demobilize and become a acting member of the South Carolina National Guard. In fact, the captain who commanded Woods Rifles, the, you know, stellar National mm-hmm. Guard company, running a sporting goods store as a civilian and commanding this company in the National Guard. Well, I got my introduction to Strom Thurmond on my father's shoulders at the armory of Woods Rifles as he ran for governor of South Carolina. And I'm on my father's shoulders, and I'm watching over the heads of all the other people, this guy pontificate about South Carolina, you know. And that was my introduction to Strom.
Yeah, it was something about not making politics a career.
Yeah.
Yeah. Servant of the people.
I remember my fifth grade teacher, I think her name was Sarah Bonner, was also, her husband was in my father's National Guard unit. And she was, I always had a crush on her. She was really a beautiful woman. I was only 12, I think, at the time, 11 or 12. But she was standing beside me, and I'm up on my father's shoulders, so I'm looking down on her, which was rare because she was about 5'8", 5'9". And I'm looking at her, and she's going like, she's just effusing, you know, ooh, this guy's really good. I'm going to vote for him. And so forth. And I'm listening to him talking and thinking, what is this political stuff?
I'm not interested in that. I'll never go into that. And then
I was happy, though, because I was in love with Miss Bonner. I mean, you know, you're in love with your fifth grade teacher if she's beautiful. And she was all the time slapping me with a ruler. And I just hold my hand out and say, go ahead and slap me. I just wanted to be close to her.
Well, I want to get your opinion on this latest blurb from Trump. So Trump is now not only demanding that the Arabs pay for everything, he's planning on taking 20% of the value of every ship that passes through the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, he's got a viceroy running Venezuela and banking $300 billion in the U.S. Treasury.
That's true.
Why not do the same thing to the other part of the world you covet? You know, I think Doug McGregor and others are right when they talk about from really just south of Basra all the way down to Muscat, there used to be somewhere around 67 million people.
Yeah.
Now there's probably about 20 million. Because the other 47 have left.
Mm-hmm.
So Kuwait, Qatar, UAE in particular, Bahrain in particular, are all being abandoned, especially by the cognoscenti, the rich and the people who got money. Yeah. So what we're doing is we are putting our military forces in there to replace those people and occupying those spaces and bombing the hell with HIMARS and other things, Iran. From that position, this is totally untenable, and it's not accomplishing anything except making 93 million people resolute and making China and Russia resolute in their support. We're just frittering. You know, we have ships now on the high seas. We have Aegis cruisers. We have DDGs. We have other ships that are steaming around with half their missile silos unloaded.
No missiles?
We don't have any missiles to put in them. Why are we using the whole family of HIMARS? Well, we're using the whole family of HIMARS because they have the range basically to cross the Gulf. They include everything from MLRS to ATACMS, and we're going to expend all those.
But okay, ATACMS can get across the Gulf. They can go a little deeper into Iran, but
yeah, it's got a 500-kilometer range.
Yeah, and it's 200-some kilometers just to get across the Gulf.
Yeah,
and then what?
And we're not hitting anything. Look at the map. We're hitting yeah. everything on the coast, from what's the name? I can't remember the name of that one place. Abidjan, all mm-hmm. the way down to Bandar Abbas, Shabab. We're hitting everything on the coast,
but not the military.
When we're hitting something internally, like the wrestling compound. Have you yeah. seen the pictures of that? We no. utterly destroyed their wrestling compound, which was, you know, one of the premier things Iran offered to the world, was really good wrestlers. And that was their stadium, their coliseum, and all that. We bombed the shit out of it. It's totally destroyed.
I saw the for round one that they took out a football stadium. It was a really nice stadium. Yeah. And apparently took out a bunch of kids that were practicing in their girls' team and a boys' team.
Got very yeah. close to Bushehr reactor also.
Yeah.
Can't make this stuff up. These are, in my view, we are the war criminal state of the world now.
But
There's nothing we won't do. Our motto is kill people more generously and more wholesalely and more completely.
Yeah, they hit the first round, they hit Bashar. And there was actually some leakage. And by the way, it was heading northwest and toward Kuwait, toward the Saudis. So, you know.
You never know.
If it has a meltdown, that's all going north. If it follows the winds, the trade winds, that's going way into Saudi Arabia. Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Turkey.
It's not a precedent we should be setting, let alone something we should be doing specifically in and of itself. It's just not something we should be doing. I mean, Ukraine should have proved that.
Oh, yeah.
The different reactors that we got so damn close to.
Well, you know, okay, so Congress supposedly have voted, took down the War Powers Act as far as Trump was. You know, he couldn't start a new conflict. So he starts a new conflict and informs Congress, I'm just starting another conflict.
There's nothing that the Congress can do to restrain this president. Nothing. They simply can't. Constitutionally, there's nothing because he's disregarded the Constitution.
True.
And in terms of their, you know, people would say things like this, but they're absolutely right. Show me your police force. Show me your law enforcement force. Show me your weapons, Congress. You don't have shit. Therefore, you are feckless. And Trump knows that.
That kind of sounds like the what Stalin said about when the Pope, they sold something, yeah. He was pretty sure the Pope won't be happy. He's like, how many yeah. divisions does the Pope have?
Yeah.
How many divisions? Exactly. But the military's, you know, the pledge at stake, and it's to the Constitution, not to the president.
The 4 stars in particular, but the 3 stars in general, have dual allegiance. Their allegiance is to both the Congress, basically to tell the truth, and to the executive, basically to wage war. The Constitution is clear on that. This military, in my mind, embarrasses the hell out of me, especially its flag officers.
Yeah.
There's not a one of them with the guts to stand up, or if there has been, they've been fired, and they've been few and far between. Maybe the Southern Command commander, maybe that Navy 3-star that got sent back out to the field. They have actually registered some complaints about what's going on, but otherwise they're compliant, they're complicit. And this is a rogue nation in terms of violation of international law. I mean, we're not a signatory to the Rome Statute, but if we were, we'd have to be taken into arms and incarcerated.
Yeah, the Trump administration was quoting the laws of the sea as far as the straits, which it's not a signatory to. It never, yeah. It's international law, but you're not part of that international law.
I don't think Iran is either.
No, it's not.
I remember right. Yeah,
unclassified. A lot of these things, a lot of major nations aren't. It's like everybody was talking. I mean, I was asked on Russian television and U.S. Podcast a lot about cassette mines or, you know, Okay, in Russian, it's cassette mines, but I can't think of the English version.
Cluster munitions?
Cluster munitions, that's it, cluster munitions. But it's against the law. Yeah, well, no, it's against an agreement by some nations that Russia, Ukraine, US, China, and I don't think any major nation really signed it. I'm not counting the French and the British as major nations. But
And yet we will cite the law of the sea as a defense or an explanation or both of our freedom of navigation exploits. The main reason we're not signatory to the law of the sea, as I understand it, and believe me, Powell and I both worked on getting various treaties for the first time in a long time, actually before the Congress and ratified, because we thought it would be a major achievement to get some of these things ratified that we thought were in the interest of the United States. UNCLOS was one of them. What we ran up against was the people like ExxonMobil and others who wanted to rape, pillage, and plunder the continental shelf and the economic zone and elsewhere, and they were powerful, and no one in the Congress was going to stand up to them. So we never even got the opportunity to introduce the treaty to a possible ratification.
Yeah, no, they're big money. I mean, no, nobody can deny that. Especially the Gulf. What's the Gulf now? Gulf of Mexico, America, Trump. What's the name this week?
The Gulf of Death. If
That.
you are a fisherman on the high seas, beware, you might die tomorrow morning.
Jeez, that are they still doing that?
Yes. Well, I think we're over 209 dead now in the
Really?
Pacific and the Caribbean. Yeah.
I know there's a couple of hits in the Pacific, but then it's gone off the radar totally. There's
Well,
not.
we don't advertise it. We don't advertise it. The document that authorized it by the Justice Department is top secret.
Really?
This is George W. Bush on steroids.
Ooh. Wow.
At least we could rail about the Justice Department decision that John Yoo and David Addington essentially orchestrated that said torture is just short of organ failure. Therefore, have a doctor at the bed you're torturing them on.
As you torture somebody, that's
Oh,
morally acceptable. I mean, we're not going to
wait a
kill
minute.
you.
He died. It was torture. Oh.
We try to resuscitate him to torture him some more, but he quit. He just,
Yeah.
oh,
He
wow.
died on us. He died on us. You're a torturer now. You killed him.
Bastard just didn't want to be tortured anymore. How dare he?
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah, it's the same thing as people said, waterboarding is not torture. Really? You want
Right.
to line up and experiment on that?
Right. Yeah. If you've ever even experienced it for a moment, you know it's torture.
I've almost drowned a few times, so I can, I know how that feels. So gotta learn how to swim. I was one of those some people run away from the water. I'm like, no, this ain't gonna happen again. I'm gonna learn how to swim. Damn it. I was a small kid, but that was horrible. I mean that's an experience that sticks with you for the rest of your life. So I can only imagine, having that water poured down your throat till you're drowning. It's
It's we did a little bit of experimentation of that. I went through three different prisoner of war experiences where we spent 3 days in what was called one of them was called the roughest of the survival and prisoner of war experiences, and the other one was called somewhere in between, and the other one was called really light.
really like.
All three of them, I wound up being the ranking man in the POW experience. So, the obligation, I'm sure it's the same with other countries, but the obligation of the ranking man in any prisoner of war status is to immediately form a committee and
Right.
begin to planning escape and other
Right.
things. And so they went after me big time in one in particular because they knew I was a Army captain on the outside. You're nothing but a Ranger candidate in the program. But they knew I was an Army captain on the outside. So I'm missing a portion of tooth from where a sergeant slapped me in the face so hard he broke my tooth.
Really? Was that the light or was that the hard version?
That was the sort of middle of the road version. I will say this, that sergeant was relieved of his duties in the POW experience and sent back to his unit because he wasn't
Wow.
supposed to do that kind of thing. I mean, my tooth lying on the floor or the piece of my tooth lying.
Well, Sobibor, the Nazi extermination camp, the only one where there was actually a revolt, and it wasn't the actual part that they went and killed people. It was the people that worked that were kept to the POWs. There was a revolt, and they overthrew the guards, and there were several hundred people that ran out. But the big mistake for the Germans was this was the only time that they took Jews in the Soviet Army who were officers, POWs, and they threw them into that camp along with civilians. Now, the civilians, whatever they told them, the civilians did. And then all of a sudden, you got these Red Army officers in there, and the first thing they did is form a committee, and they start working their way on how to throw off the
Yeah,
Germans
how
to
to
take
get
control
out.
of the camp. So,
Yeah.
and there you go.
Yeah.
The Germans were dumb enough to repeat that mistake, but yeah, they learned from that. But so yeah, as soon as you get the officers in, that's what they do. We're the sergeants, start forming committees.
I watched a movie the other day that with Michael Caine and Sylvester Stallone and a couple of British actors whose names you'd recognize. I don't remember them, but Michael Caine, of course, is British too, but it was about the soccer.
Oh
It was all
yeah.
fictitious. Have you ever seen that movie where they
I
form a soccer team?
yeah,
They
I
actually,
know the movie, but I haven't seen it. I know the
yeah,
story behind it.
it's really a neat movie. It never, I guess it never happened. Maybe there was some precedent of something like that happening, but they actually beat the Germans.
Yeah, it was in a concentration camp in Kyiv. In the Soviet Union, well, the Germans were controlling, and they were told to lose, and they refused to lose. They
Yeah,
won,
well, these
and then
guys
they
were
all got
too.
shot for that. And
Yeah,
after
yeah, yeah. These guys engineered their escape out of the soccer room where they were, supposed to be taking their showers and things.
yep. The real guys didn't get a chance. They were all then summarily executed for showing up the Germans.
Sylvester Stallone, of course, had to work his way along some pipes with his shirt off and all.
Yeah. Can't miss that. Was that before he or after he wiped out whole battalions of Vietnamese and
Yeah,
Rambo?
this was really early. He must not have been but about 22 or 23. Really, those sleepy bedroom eyes, those muscles and everything, and not much of an actor.
Well, I mean, the guy's in pretty good shape. He's got to be, what,
Oh,
80 about right now?
yeah, tremendous shape.
Oh yeah,
Tremendous shape. Yeah.
I saw him
Still.
in some series he had where he's a mob boss, like Kansas City
Yeah.
or someplace like that.
He
He,
still looks pretty good.
yeah. I wouldn't give him 80, maybe 60. Some of them in his 60s.
Yeah.
He's in good shape. But
Very much so.
now the real team got executed. They didn't. It wasn't a happy ending. There was a Russian movie that was made about him 5 or 6 years ago, about that
So
team.
this actually happened, though.
Oh yeah. It
Yeah.
was in it was under German occupation of Kyiv. And
Okay.
there were POWs as far as I
Maybe
remember. They were POW.
that's where they got the idea for this
Yeah,
movie.
yeah. It just didn't have a good end. Well, I mean, it had a happy ending, and they beat the Germans because the Germans were supposed to have this to show that they're the Aryans and they'll beat these Slavs and all that. And they were told, throw the game or it's your lives, and they didn't throw the game. They won, and then they got shot. Was it a good idea? I don't know. At the end of the
That was
day,
impractical.
we made our point, then we got shot.
Yeah. We made 3 points and then we got shot.
Exactly. So, yeah. Well, Trump's out making his third round of points, and I don't think they may. Well, did you see the videos that the Iranians are now? I mean, it's got to feed Trump's paranoia like crazy. AI that they're going to assassinate Trump one way or the other. You're going to get it whether you're on a plane or eating food. Like, holy crap! They upped.
I think he enjoys that. I really do. I think he has some psychological fixation on his own death and the martyrdom that would occur You know, long live the king. The king's dead. Long live the king. Trump will be both the dead king and the long live the king. he's got this. The guy is just an enigma in many respects. Yeah. In some, he's not. He's a grifter. He's making tons of money. His family's making tons of money off these fluctuations in the stock market alone. Witkoff and Kushner, I'm told, have made between them in their diplomatic efforts on the sides over $2 billion each.
Holy.
Kushner has made deals that just astronomical sums that he's supposed to reap if the deals come about. So all of this is much about making money, which is Trump's only true strength. He knows how to make money crookedly most of the time, but he knows how to make it.
Wow.
And he's using the presidency to do that.
Yeah.
He's even playing the oil markets now, I'm told. And now China has thrown a new wrinkle into the oil markets, which you're probably aware of. China has now become OPEC in reverse. That is to say, OPEC could influence the price of oil by slowing the production, by increasing the production. China is influencing the price by not buying because they are such a huge buyer.
Yeah. That's, you know.
Or by buying. Right now, they're contemplating refilling their strategic petroleum reserve and doing it fast. If they do that, they're going to influence the price of oil on the market because the demand is going to be horrendous to do
that.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we have a new phenomenon in the oil markets. It's called China and the power of their economic.
Trump's approach to bankruptcy. You know, if you owe the bank $1 billion, who owns the bank? Suddenly you own the bank, you know,
Trump
at that point.
Owns everything now, I think. I mean, Marco Rubio owns Venezuela.
And he's got his eyes on Cuba too while we're at it, and Nicaragua.
$300 billion of Venezuelan money in the U.S. Treasury. $300 billion. Yeah. Managing it now for Venezuela's good.
And how much of the cream is he taking off the top of that?
Well,
the top 30%.
Darcy Rodriguez is his peon now.
Oh yeah,
she does whatever he tells her to do.
It's incredible to watch. Which you know you got a feel for Machado. I mean, she thought she was going to be running the show. She gave Trump her Nobel Prize. I thought she deserved it, and then she just gets tossed to the side. That's it. Sorry.
We have put a number of troops into Venezuela to help them with the fighting the detritus of the earthquake. But
you
know, that hardly makes up for robbing them blind.
$300 billion would go a very long way to fixing that country.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. If he gets not, basically they're running Panama now too. So with the Panama Canal,
we will take whatever we need to take. We've just taken, I think, the whole coastline of the Persian Gulf from Basra down to Muscat, with the only objection being the Omanis on occasion.
Yeah. Well, taking and holding are two different things at this rate.
Very much so. Yeah. Very much so. And why would you want to hold it? Why would you want to hold it? It's a basket case right now. You only want to hold it so you can launch missiles at reasonable range at Iran because your longer range stuff is running out.
Yep.
Absolutely. And you lose your airplanes.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, sir, I know we're running late on time. I want to thank you for joining. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And
what an eclectic conversation we had.
Yes, it is. People like that. That you know, they like wow. It's like because it's not just the A, B, C questions, you know, and then chopped answers. It's a very lovely conversation. It grows. I always enjoy it. Yeah, me too. Me too. And I hope
you
to.
Know,
You
notice I've got my Barcelona shirt on.
Yeah, I was gonna say it.
You know, I said this morning to Nima Alkershid, I said, you know, isn't it funny that the only country in South America that is competitive and might even win the FIFA World Cup is one that has good relations, Buenos Aires, with the United States.
Isn't yeah, that that's a good weird? Point.
Isn't that sort of weird? And you also had Trump weigh in on the striker for the U.S. team, who got a red card and should not have played in the next game, but did and got whomped.
Oh, geez.
But,
that's...
I mean, this is supposed to be an indifferent to prejudice FIFA.
Oh, we've already seen the Olympics the way they went. I mean, it's...
And look at what we did to the Iranian team.
Oh, geez. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's just... Yeah. When the presidents are weighing in on football matches, for seriously, gentlemen.
There is nothing Trump won't touch.
There isn't.
With a bomb, with a sanction, or with his swimming personality.
Well, I mean, hell, he already had the Thunderdome on the front yard or the backyard of the White House. I think they should have kept the dome in there. Let the politicians fight it out. This is how we're going to determine votes.
And we're arresting all these cretins who are trying to impact the tidal pool.
Yeah, that was...
That man's messing with the paint. Get him.
God, that... Yeah. Well... He Trump's providing a lot of comedy relief for the rest of the world.
I know.
Sad to say that, you know.
It may be comedy relief, but it's tragic.
It is. Tragic comedy, absolutely. It is. It absolutely is. You know, as I tell people, they're like, oh, what do you think of this or that with Trump? It's like, Trump's like that old grandfather that's sitting on there and says, yeah, back in 19, 1,500,000, when I stood there with my musket and took down 100 redcoats. It's like, yeah, that's a great story. That's great. But unfortunately, he's
I know all about war. I studied war my whole life. I know all about it. I'm better than any of the generals.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Five Deferments, not to go to Vietnam. Yeah.
he's proving he's better than any of the generals right now in this fiasco called war with Iran.
Well, you said it right now. Yeah, Vietnam was run stupidly. I could have done a better job. Then why didn't you go?
Yeah.
Five deferments, man. Why didn't you go? Yeah.
Agreed.
Whole new version of armchair general. Except the armchair's in the Oval Office.
Armchair constitutionalist, armchair president, armchair general, armchair asshole.
He's very good at the last one. Sir, thank you for joining. Hope to talk to you soon again.
You take care.
It is a pleasure. It is always a pleasure.
What does das Vidaniya mean?
Goodbye. Like a formal das goodbye.
Das Vidaniya. I thought so.
Well, better paka, which is like see you later.
What is it?
Paka.
Baka.
With a P. With a P. Paka.
With a P. Bakpa.
Paka.
Baka.
Mm-hmm.
Baka. I like Das Vidaniya. take care.
You too, sir. Thank you.
See you. Bye-bye.